Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. One of the most intractable social challenges in America is poverty. We learned yesterday from the U.S. Census Bureau that the poverty rate last year was unchanged from the year before. That was the sliver of good news. The bad news is that poverty has been growing steadily in recent years, and today one in six Americans, more than 46 million people, live below the poverty line. For a family of four, that means surviving on about $23,000 a year.
Meanwhile, income inequality grew sharply last year. The richest 20% of Americans saw their incomes grow, while everyone else's wages remained flat or declined. The most recent data available for Massachusetts back in 2009 show similar trends. Income inequality is on the rise, and about 1 in 10 Bay State residents live in poverty.
So why does poverty remain such a vexing problem in one of the world's richest countries? And in an election year, why aren't the candidates talking about it more or at all? In a moment, we're going to be talking about poverty and inequality with two experts. But listeners, we want to hear from you.
Do you see a problem with income inequality in Greater Boston? Are you a top earner whose wages are growing? Are you stuck at minimum wage? What's preventing Boston's poorest residents from getting ahead? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston.
And joining us from Cambridge is William Julius Wilson. He's a professor of sociology and social policy at Harvard. Back in 1987, he wrote a groundbreaking book called The Truly Disadvantaged, The Inner City, The Underclass, and Public Policy. 25 years later, he's releasing a second edition. And Professor Wilson, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And here in the studio with us is Northeastern University Professor Barry Bluestone. He's an economist and director of Northeastern's Kitty and Michael Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. He's also founding dean of Northeastern School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs. And Barry Bluestone, welcome back to Radio Boston. Always great to have you.
Good to be back.
So, Bill Wilson, let me start with you. The second edition of your book, The Truly Disadvantaged, it's the focus of a day-long conference at Harvard tomorrow with more than 20 leading social sciences scientists, scholars, including Barry Bluestone and yourself. You argue that a quarter century later, since the publication of that book, not much has changed. There are still major racial differences and concentrated poverty. So lay it out for us. Where are we right now in terms of poverty and inequality in the U.S.?
Well, I think the conditions that I described in The Truly Disadvantaged, published in 1987, are not that different 25 years later. You know, we still have major racial differences in concentrated poverty. That is poverty in which a high percentage of people live in a particular area, concentrated poverty. And the country did experience rather dramatic declines in concentrated poverty in the 1990s, but unemployment and individual poverty rates have increased significantly since then, in part mainly due to the downturn in the economy. And there's every reason to assume that concentrated poverty rates are on the increase again, although we have to wait for a complete analysis of the 2010 census data before we can provide a precise analysis of what's happened with concentrated poverty most recently.
I want to talk about a couple of those themes that you brought up. But first, let me come to you, Barry Bluestone. We've heard that quick overview from Bill. How are you seeing this play out in Massachusetts and Greater Boston? When we talk about concentrated poverty and the poverty rate in general, where are we?
Well, like the rest of the country, we've seen a tremendous increase in inequality. Those folks who are in the upper class, are doing as well as they did ever, probably doing much better. Mm. But we see that, particularly given this Great Recession, that people who began with low incomes have seen their incomes fall. More and more of it is concentrated in smaller and smaller areas of the city. I think the important thing we have to realize is that for most families, not the elderly, poverty is deeply related to joblessness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, for example, at the latest statistics I'm comparing here 1970 and 2010. In Boston, in 1970, black men aged 16 to 64, so prime age workers, about 75% of them were working. In 2010, only 60%.
Hmm.
So the loss of jobs has been the critical element. And if you go back to the city where I grew up, in Detroit, much of it, of course, is due to the deindustrialization, the loss of manufacturing jobs. If you look at 25 to 54-year-olds, you expect most of them to be working. Among black men in Boston in 1970, 85% were working, which was about the same as white men. Today, 69%. So the loss of job opportunity and the inability of folks to find jobs and then facing long-term unemployment, which makes it even more difficult to get a job, has led to this concentrated poverty. And it's been particularly true in the inner city and, unfortunately, particularly true of black families and black men.
Now, Bill Wilson, what Barry Bluestone just laid out is at the heart of a lot of what you write about in The Truly Disadvantaged. That is, I mean, one of the issues at play here is a sort of change in the job market, a significant change in the job market, right?
Yes, certainly. The jobless rates in the inner city neighborhoods have increased significantly, but because of the economic downturn, we've seen a substantial rise in unemployment across racial and ethnic groups. You know, so much so that the black-white unemployment ratio, which seemed to be essentially fixed at 2.0 or greater, which means that the black unemployment rate was at least twice the white unemployment rate through both economic upturns and downturns. Well, during this economic downturn, since 1990, the black-white ratio has dipped below 2.0. Why? Because of the sharp increase in joblessness among whites. So we've seen a significant spread of joblessness across racial and ethnic groups.
You wrote in the after foreword of the second edition of The Truly Disadvantaged, you write that the country, and you mentioned this a moment ago, that the country experienced dramatic declines in concentrated poverty in the 1990s, including declines in urban black neighborhoods.
Yes.
What contributed to those declines? And I'm asking that question by way of trying to understand what has to happen to make them dip down again, to make those poverty rates...
Yeah, well, we had a big economic boom during the 1990s, especially in the latter 1990s, which resulted in sharp drops in unemployment. People were working and they were moving out of poverty. And as you improve the economy and you increase jobs, then the poverty rate decreases, and then that also affects concentrated poverty.
But were there specific, and I'll ask Barry Bluestone, come back into the conversation here. I mean, were there specific policies in that period that we should be looking at now that help bring policy rates down, poverty rates down?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with significant productivity growth. I'm not going to try to identify policies of the Clinton administration. This is when we experienced the sharp rise in employment and the sharp drop in unemployment, but certainly productivity growth significantly improved during his administration, and it could very well be that he had macroeconomic policies that also spurred economic growth. But Barry, you're the economist; you could address that issue better than I can.
Well, one of the things we did is we did spur economic growth at the time. We did have a tax cut. We had increases in spending. We had increases in spending on workforce training programs. Of course, we didn't face the kind of deficits we have now. In fact, we had surpluses in the last 4 years of the Clinton administration. You know, I think when we look across the country, if we look outside of Boston, you'll find in cities like Detroit, where I grew up, or Milwaukee, where a recent study has been completed, a lot of this has to do with the deindustrialization that Bill talked about in his 1987 book, and Ben Harrison of MIT and I talked about in our 1982 Deindustrialization of America. There was such a sharp drop in manufacturing, and production workers got clobbered. So if you look, for example, in Milwaukee in 1970, 54.3% of black men were working as production workers. 54%, more than half. By 2007, 2009, only 15%. You know, we have this theory of Joseph Schumpeter of creative destruction. We're constantly creating new jobs, but we're destroying old. Old industries die, like the buggy whip industry, but then you get the auto industry. You go out of agriculture. We once had 30% of our workforce, many of them sharecroppers in the South. They were able to come north and get good jobs in the auto industry in Detroit. It made Detroit the richest community in America in 1960. But as manufacturing declined in many of these cities, less so here in Massachusetts, certainly less so in Boston, black workers lost those production jobs. Some of them found new jobs in healthcare, in education, in services. But unfortunately, many of the new jobs did not pay anything near what those manufacturing jobs did. Bill talked about productivity growth. We had vast productivity growth in the manufacturing sector, which led to the possibility of high wages. We didn't have the same kind of productivity growth in healthcare and other sectors. And so you might have still been employed, but you were now working poor. And then many, as these numbers tell us, lost their jobs altogether.
Listeners, we're talking about the stubborn, the vexing problem of poverty and how it remains. We're talking about 46 million Americans living in poverty. We're doing slightly better, a good deal better here in Massachusetts. We're at a 10% poverty rate, but still unacceptable. What's your take on this? What's preventing the cities, the nation's poorest residents from getting ahead? You can give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's take a couple of calls. Let's go to Laura, who's calling from Watertown. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
I just wanted to share my story because I think that a big part of the problem is the individual believing in themselves. And you say that there's a lack of jobs out there, and we can create our own jobs. So I, 7.5 years ago, was and still am a single mother who lived off of $125 a week, a month, in low-income housing. I put myself through graduate school. I have over $100,000 in loans. And when I was living in low-income housing, I realized that I was surrounded by this victimhood mentality. And I offered, I'm an acupuncturist, and I offered acupuncture for free to everyone, and no one wanted it. Someone wanted it for their boyfriend, but she couldn't take it for herself. And then I realized that I, too, shared this victimhood mentality because I had suffered some abuse in my childhood that I thought after working 10-plus years on, I had overcome, but realized I had not. And then by focusing on myself and loving myself and believing in myself and setting my intentions on what I wanted to create, who I wanted to attract into my life, I was able to create a very successful business. I moved out of low-income housing. I rent a 4-bedroom home in West Newton with my daughter. I rent my own office space, and I have a really successful business, and I did this with my mind, with my will, and by loving myself and healing myself.
Well, Laura, I'm going to really thank you for this story. It's inspiring, and I'm sure it means a lot to a lot of people. And I want to move on and take a couple of other calls to get their thoughts. Let's go to John, who is calling from Swampscott. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
Yeah, I think that poverty, you know, it's obviously a huge problem in this country, and I think it's important to look at what the nature of the problem is, and in my opinion, it's definitely systemic, it's cultural, and it's also a values issue. And I think in this country, people's values seem to be along the lines of it's okay for CEOs to make $2 million while, you know, other employees make less than $20,000, which, as you said, would be under the poverty level, the poverty guidelines, which are, in fact, actually a lot of studies show that the poverty level does not reflect what is actually what people need, basically. So I think that the values in this country have to change if poverty is really going to change. I think people need to start talking about equality issues and taking care of your fellow man.
Yeah, so when he talks about values, he's talking about the extent to which we are committed to addressing the problem of inequality, I take it.
Is that what you mean, John?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah.
And, you know, one of the reasons why it's so difficult to end poverty is that is because poverty is not high on a nation's priority list.
Mm.
You know, if we really dedicate ourselves to ending poverty, we could significantly reduce poverty within a period of a few years. And I'm not exaggerating. I think, for example, of the poverty rate of older Americans, it dropped significantly after the war on poverty because of Medicare programs like Medicare and so on. And so there was a sharp drop. You could say declining significance of poverty among older Americans because of programs such as Medicare. So we just have not really, we haven't really dedicated ourselves to addressing this problem, but if we do, I think we could significantly reduce poverty in a relatively short period of time.
So in other words, we know how to do it. We had, earlier this spring, we had Peter Edelman in here, former aide to President Clinton,
yes.
who famously resigned over welfare reform. But in his book, So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America, he said, "We did a lot about poverty to the point where there would be something like 40 million more people in poverty now without such things as food stamps,
right.
Earned income tax credit, and the indexing of Social Security to inflation." So, William Julius Wilson, sounds like you would agree with that. We know how to do this.
Absolutely.
If we would just commit to it.
Right. That's the point.
Mm.
Can we generate a commitment? Can we put poverty high on the public agenda list?
Barry Bluestone.
Well, it's not theoretical. There are facts for this. When we indeed did declare the war on poverty that Bill talked about in the Lyndon Johnson administration, we saw poverty come down in about a decade from 22% of all Americans to about 12 to 13% of all Americans. So we knew we had programs that could do it, but in some sense, before we ended the war, we declared it over. And then, of course, poverty bumped along the bottom at about 12 to 13%, and now it's back to 15%, what it was 30 years ago. So Bill's absolutely right, as is your caller, that if we really had a commitment to try and end poverty, we know what to do. We know what kinds of programs to do for people who can't work, including the elderly. We know what kinds of programs we need to do, including workforce training and dealing with questions of rebuilding our manufacturing base to get people back to work so they're out of poverty.
Well, let me ask you both this, because I find this truly fascinating, and this is a subject that I've been interested in for a long time and flummoxed by. But I'm really struck by the current race for the White House. There's a lot of focus on the middle class, understandably so. That's where most of the voters are. But there's almost no mention of poverty. 46 million Americans, according to the Census Bureau, that's the highest number of Americans in the history of keeping records that people are in poverty. And yet we're not talking about it. And so no wonder we're not coming up with solutions if we're not talking about it in a presidential contest. Let me come back to you on that point, William Julius Wilson.
Well, let me just say this. Yes, we're not talking about it. It's not a major issue in the campaign, but that doesn't mean that the Obama administration has not been addressing the problems of the poor.
Mm.
I think, quite frankly, that Obama's programs have prevented poverty from being even worse, from rapidly rising. You know, he had, take his stimulus package, he earmarked $80 billion for low-income Americans, you know, included such things as an extension of unemployment benefits, it included a temporary increase in the earned income tax credit, it included substantial additional funds for food stamps, it included nearly $4 billion in job training and workforce enhancement, $2 billion for neighborhood stabilization efforts.
So and without also, that, we'd be much worse off, you're saying.
Right, and I consider the health care legislation as an anti-poverty program. Mm. And over the long term, the health care legislation will significantly benefit lower-income Americans.
But if voters were clamoring for more, you know, and really saying 46 million Americans in poverty in the richest country in the world, would we be making even more progress?
Barry? Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, I think there's no doubt we would. The problem we have, and we just saw the new statistics come out from the census, that median household income, so you're talking about middle Americans,
yeah,
their income now, controlling for inflation, is no better than it was in 1995. So middle income families are hurting. They're hurting real bad.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people who are unemployed, in fact, aren't poor, but they're getting poor because they've lost their job and they're long-term unemployed. So it's somewhat natural to pay some attention to the middle class. You know, everybody thinks those guys played by the rules and they're not doing very well. And so a lot of the campaign is around that. There's a more cynical position, and that is, unfortunately, poor people just don't vote as in large numbers like middle class people do. And, of course, in a tight, tight election like this one will be in November, they're looking for every kind of vote, and appealing to middle class people and their problems is something that gets you votes.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a reason, though, Bill Wilson, I mean, should, I mean, to play the cynic, why should middle-class voters care about the poverty rate?
Well, because they're running into similar problems that poor people have experienced. You know, the average household income fell for the bottom four-fifths of the income distribution. In that latest report, even though it rose among those in the top fifth, and especially among the super rich, and the most dramatic difference between the what we call the period of equality from 1940 to about 1979, and the period of inequality after 1979, the most dramatic difference between these two periods is the pronounced and widening income gap between the rich and the middle class.
Mm.
You know, all groups have, lower income groups have suffered during this period, but the gap between the middle class and the rich has increased significantly.
Whereas the gap between the middle class and the impoverished, not so big, perhaps.
No, it hasn't increased. It's slightly increased, but not nearly as much as the gap between the middle class and the rich. And so, in a sense, we're all sort of in this sinking economic boat. And the message should be that we're experiencing somewhat similar problems, and that is declining incomes.
You know, I want to go back to something that I read in Peter Edelman's book. As long as middle-income voters think they have more in common with the people at the top than the people at the bottom, we are cooked. And he goes on to say the challenge is to get people in the middle to understand which side of the line they are on.
Right, and the question is, are they understanding that? That's the point.
Well, there's a great question for listeners. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about poverty in Boston, poverty across the country. William Julius Wilson is with me, and Barry Bluestone. Barry.
Well, you know, there is a real good reason why middle-income families should be concerned about low-income families. Mm. With the expansion in poverty, with more and more people in poverty, these are families who can't buy things. And if they can't buy things, that means we see companies in trouble, we see production going down, we see more layoffs. That we've had such a skewed income to people at the very top who are putting more of their money away in savings because they've bought everything they want, and low-income people who are seeing their incomes shrink still further and therefore cutting back on their spending hurts the middle class more than anybody else. Middle class is producing those things. If low-income people don't have the income to buy it, they lose their jobs because low-income people have become even poorer. So Bill's absolutely right, as is your caller, that the prospects for the middle class are actually intimately tied up with those people below them and vice versa.
Let's take a call. Dan is calling from Needham. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to make the observation that, you know, and you just touched on it here, that poverty rates are intrinsically intertwined with our entire economic situation right now, where our recovery is stagnant. It's indicative in the income rates of those in the lower and the middle. As those remain stagnant against inflation, we're not going to see any type of meaningful progressive recovery. You know, it's exactly like we said. You know, if you can't afford stuff to buy, you can't buy it, you can't put that money into the economy. And that's really what we're looking at here. We need to find a way to incentivize those at the top to hire more people from the bottom.
Dan, we appreciate the call, and it's a great sentiment. Let me go to Helen, who is calling from Braintree. Hi, Helen, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, and thanks so much for having this conversation.
Sure.
I just want to say, I don't know why I haven't heard any conversation about minimum wage in this country. Minimum wage in this country is a joke. No one can live on it. And the other thing is that we've seen a rise in inflation that hasn't accompanied wages.
Mm.
So we keep seeing, for my example, I make roughly $50,000 a year. I had a 1.7% increase in my wages this year, but my child care has gone up, my rent has gone up, my car insurance, food. And at this rate,
You're going backwards, Helen. Right. You're moving in the wrong direction at this rate. Helen, thank you for the call, and I wish you the best. And I want to talk about the minimum wage, and let me come to you, Bill Wilson, because according to the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, the minimum wage in 1968 was $10.52 if you adjust for inflation.
Yes.
Today, the minimum wage is $8. So Helen raises an interesting point. How important is the minimum wage?
It's very important. Minimum wage has not kept pace with inflation, and it's primarily political decisions. People have decided that poor people are not that important, because earlier, you know, prior to 1970, there were significant increases in the minimum wage. But beginning with the Reagan administration, minimum wages just were not keeping pace with inflation, and right now the real value of the minimum wage does not even begin to compare with what it was several decades ago. Barry, do you know the difference?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's mm-hmm. certainly fallen, as the center here points out, from $10.52 to $8 in real terms.
Yeah.
The fact is, there are two things that have been more important for the working families in this country at the low end. One has been the minimum wage, the other is the earned income tax
mm-hmm.
credit,
right,
which is kind of like a negative income tax. And we were building that up. I remember I was working for Congressman Gebhardt in the 1990s, and we increased the earned income tax credit, and it had a significant impact on reducing poverty of working families. The minimum wage is the same. Part of the reason why some economists are opposed to increasing the minimum wage is they believe that it will harm jobs. But there's very little evidence that it does it in practice. It only does it in theory.
Well, gentlemen, big topic, vexing challenge that is with us generation after generation. I thank you both for coming in and making a great start on talking about it. Thank you very much. William Julius Wilson, professor of sociology and policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was the author of The Truly Disadvantaged, upon which there is a conference at Harvard tomorrow. You can find a lot more information. Bill Wilson, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thank you. My pleasure.
And Professor Barry Bluestone, economist and director of Northeastern's Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. You're going to be at that conference tomorrow at Harvard. Thank you for coming in.
Appreciate Always nice it. To be here.
Stay with us. Coming up, history and art merge in Rhode Island School of Design's Witness Tree Project. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.